The United States locks up more people than any other country. More than 2 million people live in prison. That's more than China, which has more than three times as many people. We go back and forth on the purpose of prison, with some of society thinking it's only to punish, some thinking it should rehabilitate people for their eventual release. Today we'll talk about the Compassion Prison Project, which uses the research into adverse childhood experiences and trauma-informed care to provide at least some insight to people in prison. It started in one California prison. Fritzi Horstman is the filmmaker and producer who founded the Compassion Prison Project, and she's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Fritzi, welcome.
Thank you so much, Jeff. It's such a great honor to be here. And just to hear you talk about my organization, it just feels so magnificent. So thank you.
Glad to reflect it back to you. So talk about the spark, the idea that first led to Compassion Prison Project.
I volunteered at a maximum security prison in 2018. I walked in there with my own preconceived notions about what a criminal or a person who had committed crimes was. I walked in there and my entire world changed because I knew what we were doing was completely perverse. The people in prison are traumatized, highly, highly traumatized. And when I realized that, I realized we needed mental health services and compassion more than we needed retribution and annihilation.
Well, how did you develop the program from there then? I mean, so you realize that this is not a good thing, but then a bunch of different ways you could have gone.
Well, what happened was I had just read a book called The Body Keeps the Score, and I realized that I was traumatized. I had been traumatized as a child. I have an ACE score of 8. I don't know if you know what an ACE is, and it's an adverse childhood experience.
Yes.
And so with an ACE, a score of 8, that's a very high dose of adversity for a child. And what I realized is that most of the people had ACE scores of we did research, and what we found is 79% of the people in prison have ACE scores of 4 or more. And the national average is about 15%. So the people in prison have dealt with so much adversity before they've even committed a crime. And so I went and I went and researched compassion and created probably the most ridiculous curriculum you'll ever see. But the men that I worked with, they taught me what they needed to learn. And they also taught me what I needed to learn. And so we created a circle, the Compassion Trauma Circle, which is based on the Adverse Childhood Experiences quiz. And you take a step into the circle for each adverse childhood experience that you have. We did a film called Step Inside the Circle in a different prison, in Lancaster Prison in California, with 235 men. And the site is quite stunning. So if you have a chance, visit our website at compassionprisonproject.org and see that video and see the amount of adversity that these men have experienced in their lives.
I want to ask specifically about that because I did watch Step Inside the Circle. It's not a long film. It's not even 7 minutes long, but it seemed like that as you said, okay, if this happened to you before age 18, step inside the circle. And with the first one, everybody stepped in. If anybody ever told you you had no value, you were worthless, whatever. That was, I think, the first one. And it seemed like you had men stepping forward into the circle on every adverse experience you listed.
Correct. And one of the most striking ones is traumatic brain injury. It looked like 97% stepped in for that. That's damage to your prefrontal cortex. If you have damage to your prefrontal cortex, you're not thinking straight. You're in fight or flight. Your amygdala is on fire. And, you know, we have that example yesterday with Adams Phillips, I don't remember the name, the NFL player who killed 5 people. So that's what we're dealing with. We're not dealing with immoral people. We're dealing with people who are not thinking straight. And that's the distinction we really have to start thinking about and how we're treating people in prison. And remember, 95% of the people living in prison will be our neighbors one day. And how did we want them returned to us? Devalued, homeless, and without ability to support themselves? Or do we want them to be leaders and tax-paying citizens? That's a really important question as we go forward.
Fritzi Horstmann is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, a filmmaker and producer who developed the Compassion Prison Project in California, and there's some talk of it coming to Oregon as well. You can join our conversation as we explore adverse childhood experiences and how to work through those for people in prison and what that means for the rest of us. 800-838-3760 is our phone number. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Now, ACEs is not a new study. I think the first stuff started coming in the late 80s. Is that right? It certainly has some staying power, though.
The 90s, yes. And what they found is that adverse childhood experiences determine some adverse health outcomes in adulthood. Higher autoimmune diseases, higher chance of cancer, alcoholism, depression, opioid abuse. And if you have six or more ACEs that are not resolved, you lower your life expectancy by 20 years. And that presents, actually, correctional officers have a life expectancy of 59 years old. So what we're doing in prisons is also very damaging for the people who work there, and that's something to also consider.
So talk about how hard did you have to work? Was Kern Valley State Prison the first place you went to?
Yes, and yeah, that's where I volunteered that first day, and they welcomed me back. And it was pretty easy to get in there. There's a great warden that works there. But remember, this is a maximum security prison. So, you know, it's like everyone is on high alert and a lot of PTSD. You can see the PTSD on the officers, and you can see the PTSD on the people living there. And there was, you know, it waffled. Sometimes they didn't want us in there. Sometimes they did. But some of the results we got after a year of working with those men, two of them stopped using heroin, and one of them revoked their DNR, their do not resuscitate order. And those are just kind of the dramatic differences. But everyone talks about being able to talk about their childhood trauma in a circle with people that hold this space is really a transformative process. And that's, we need that in our communities as we do in our prisons. We need to talk about what happened to us so we can transform our wounds and, you know, not be haunted by what happened to us as children.
That's a huge amount of vulnerability to display to people who you are constantly wary of and on guard against. I just wonder how much time you had to spend with people before they're willing to do some stuff like step inside the circle, or is step inside the circle the first process?
Well, actually, we vacillate between, we're creating another curriculum. We mm-hmm. vacillate between the two, and it is an incredible amount of vulnerability. And I got a letter from one of the guys who did the big circle, and he says, you know, and because of COVID, we weren't able to help them integrate what the work we had done that day, which is, you know, one of the things that really haunts me. But that vulnerability is the thing that breaks down divisions that, you know, trauma separates. Trauma makes you feel like you're separate from somebody. And when you realize that, you know, a lot of the people in your life have experienced the same thing, it kind of makes you feel like you're connected to each other. It doesn't kind of, it makes you feel like you're connected to each other. And in that exploration, there's more safety. There's actually more safety the more vulnerable you become if you can create a place where that's a good container, if that makes sense.
Well, it does. And it's also, as I think about things like, you know, just a show of hands or step into the circle or something where people communicate non-verbally something they've been through. They don't have to admit much of anything other than just, yeah, this happened to me. And I notice the faces in the films of the men looking at each other like, oh, you too. I mean, that alone seems to break some barriers, but it's also rather elegant in the fact that nobody actually has to say anything about their own experience at that point.
Exactly. And my dream is to bring this to a women's prison, to police force, to the correctional officers, to our first responders. The amount of trauma that we're living with in our own lives is almost unimaginable. And, you know, with your listeners, just think about the things that you've had to hold and not process. You know, just our addiction to coffee, our addiction to cigarettes, our addiction to alcohol, just wanting to take the edge off every day or wanting that adrenaline rush so that we can just get through the tasks we have in front of us. Those are just symptoms. That's a trauma response. You know, I'm working through my own trauma responses. It's just like, how do I want to feel? And I'm just, the thing is, we're really afraid to feel in our society. Netflix is booming because everyone can just binge for 20 hours, you know? And so it's like, what's that? What's, or the cell phone, we want to just go into our cell phone because we don't want to feel or think about what's really going on inside us.
Fritzi Horstman, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, filmmaker, producer, founder of the Compassion Prison Project, which has worked with men in California prisons. And as you can hear, Fritzi has some ideas about expanding it as well. Questions, comments, ideas about rehabilitation in prison and the value thereof. Join us on the Exchange, 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Fritzi, I'm curious to know how long it took for not just the people you worked with to trust each other or to believe each other, but how much time it took to convince them to trust you, for you to explain what you were doing, to gain their trust, to convince them that a white woman could lead men of color into some knowledge and power they did not previously have.
I think the thing that happened is I told them about my own childhood trauma, and that was almost an instantaneous connection. It makes me want to cry just thinking about it. When people see someone take that first step towards vulnerability and towards exposure, they feel safer that they can do it. And, you know, let's be leaders and take that step towards vulnerability, because we're all really hurting. And remember, trauma divides, trauma separates. So, you know, these two, like, liberal and Republicans, that's a trauma response. To fight about things that we both want. We want the same. Everybody wants safety. Everybody wants a roof over their heads. Everybody wants the Maslow's needs. So, you know, why are we fighting about how to get it? We need, you know, nonviolent communication is everybody's valued and everybody deserves to win. So how do we create a win-win society and recognize our traumas? Start there. Start saying, yes, Mitch McConnell was abused as a kid. You know, Bill Clinton was abused as a kid. Our leaders, I'm sure, and John, we know Donald Trump was abused as a kid. That's trauma. They bring trauma to their work. Unresolved trauma creates separation. And so it's really like, let's get the conversation about what happened to us. It's not what's wrong with us. And that's the key with prison. It's not what's wrong with them. It's what happened to them. They were victims way before they ever committed a crime. And when you normalize violence, that's your only route. That's the only thing. And we have to also talk about the victims that are created. We don't want more victims created when the men and women return home to us. There's a 66% recidivism rate in this country after 3 years, and after 7 years, it's 77%. That's unacceptable. That's a business that's failing, if you ask me.
Well, let's explore, though, the opposition. You mentioned we all want the same things, but there are probably some people who do criticize this approach, and I have certainly heard some of the arguments about how I do not buy that you committed murder this year because you got yelled at 20 years ago. So what do you say in response to that?
I say there's no hope. There's no hope in the person who committed murder. There's no path to an option. He's been annihilated or she's been annihilated. Her father has probably gone to prison. Her mother's probably a drug addict. She's been dehumanized. She's been beaten. She's been one of the guys on death row that I was in connection with. He was executed when Trump decided to have his execution spree. And he talked about his father blowing his brains out on his bed when he got home from school. He had brain splatter on his bed. And this was after being, you know, thrown against the wall, constant TBI, all of his childhood. And then you ask this child to function as a, you know, respectable adult. You ask this person to see a different way through the maze of just being alive, just being a teenager. You know, a lot of these crimes are created by teenagers or young adults. You ask them to function. They don't have hope. They don't have guidance. They don't have anyone who cares about them. And then, you know, and poverty, you know, Gandhi said poverty is the worst form of violence. Poverty creates so much child abuse and so much domestic violence. And we really, it's a systematic issue that I think we're starting to look at. But we have to also, as a society, take responsibility for some of this violence that we've perpetrated, you know, since we came here and started our genocide and started our slavery. These are just residual generational violence that we've perpetrated.
All right. To the generational part, there is a clip I don't want to play from your short film, Honor Yard. First, tell us what is going on in Honor Yard, just to give the general sense.
In Honor Yard, we're going around and talking about the symptoms of trauma. You know, reenactment of the crime, reenactment of the traumas, addiction, abuse, perpetuation of abuse. So, you know, child predators, child pedophiles, they've been abused. They've been sexually abused repeatedly. It becomes a compulsion. I mean, it's one of the most horrible things I can imagine on both ends. So in Honor Yard there, we're going around and we're discussing about what happens when you've been traumatized. What do we see when you're traumatized?
And here's one man's comment that really stood out to me. This takes about a minute.
In one of our classes, we were talking about the effects of slavery on our behavior. And I'm going to be honest with you, I ain't agree with it when I first heard it. But then when he talked about the discipline, I had a flashback of how I used to get whipped with a bullwhip. Naked. I didn't put the two and two together, but I realized, you know, that's how slaves was whipped. Because it was generational trauma passed on from one mother to another mother to another mother, and it passed on to me. I still got marks on my legs and stuff behind that. And I just remembered there was no one I could run to, no one could help me. And she just was telling me how much she loved me, and she cried and she beat me with a bullwhip. But I was thankful today for the opportunity to forgive myself, to forgive her, and forgive all those people who would traumatize her.
That's an amazing thing. Forgive all those people who traumatized. It's a huge thing in any life, it seems like, to forgive people for what they did to you.
Completely. It's one of the hardest things. A lot of the men that I've worked with, I mean, one guy says, I am not going to forgive my father for what he did. He was one of the heroin addicts. And one of the things I say to them is, then forgive yourself for not forgiving them. And so just so that there is the act of forgiving. And that's, you know, that's the vulnerability. It makes me cry just hearing Lester talk about his mother. But also the pain that the mother is having. I mean, when you're abusing somebody, it actually does hurt you more. It actually does destroy you as well. And, you know, just the violence, you know, road rage, that's just a one little element of violence that we're doing in our lives. Cutting someone off, that's violent. You know, just our thoughts, I'm constantly looking at my own violence every day. I have a 14-year-old son, and since I'm so traumatized, you know, his chaos really triggers me. And so I have to really say to him, I'm so sorry, honey, that I had that reaction, you know, if I snap at him or something. And just for us all to just start looking at the little microaggressions, you know, because instead let's make them micro-compassions. Let's shift our microaggressions to micro-compassions. And, you know, we do that at work all the time. It's like, I don't like the way this person is behaving, you know, and so then we start getting, you know, violent. You know, these are little violences, but they add up in our society.
Fritzi Horstman, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, filmmaker, producer, founder of the Compassion Prison Project, which is online, has a couple of short films you can watch there to get familiar with the project. And you're hearing her here on the Jefferson Exchange now and can join the conversation. Your questions, your comments are welcome at 800-838-3760 on the phone or send emails to jx@jeffnet.org. So, Fritzi, once you've got people recognizing things that have happened to them, how channel the outcomes through the Compassion Prison Project? I mean, new awareness is great, but it doesn't shorten prison sentences.
Well, then we start getting them busy. Once people get activated, once they're starting to forgive themselves, once they decide they don't want to be in a gang, or decide that the gang politics are not working for them. I mean, this is one of the big things we're dealing with. Prison is like the most racist environment there is. But once people start getting a sense of their own magnificence, really, is what that's what I'm working at, is that you are not what people say you are. You are not. It's reinforced that they have no value in prison. And so once I say, okay, let's go, let's figure out how can we get back to society? You can't get back to your victim. You can't bring that person back to life, but you can change, you know, you can do your part to give back to society. So we have a thing called the Giving Back Project. One of the things we're doing is having men write poems and spoken word and artwork and creating little books. And another man wants to do a greeting card. And if you have any, I'll ask this community. He wants to do greeting cards for children that are sick in hospitals. And if you know any hospitals that would invite greeting cards done by these exquisite artists, these artists in prison, you know, it's just the talent and the abilities in prison is just wasted resources. And let's have that, let's build that bridge to those kids. When he told me he wanted to do that, it just made me cry, just thinking of that open heart who wants to make a difference, who wants to, you know, spread his love and you know, return the favor, return the harm that he did, like, you know, sorry, the words aren't coming, but restore the harm that he created.
Yeah, restorative justice, we've talked about several times here on the program. Are there people who have done the work of the Compassion Prison Project and now been released, or is it just too young for that?
Actually, there are two people that have been released that were in our class. One of the guys, this is the long-term class, other guys from this big circle have been released as well, but one of the guys is working with us. His name is Darnell, and he's incredible. And he talks about how he talks about how incredible it was to be in a room with he's African American, but to be in a room with Latinos and whites, where on the yard everyone is against each other, and in that room the divisions were gone. And that's what healing does. When we start dealing with your trauma, we start realizing how similar we really are, and how really, I mean, the unity, we are in this all together, and we know that. And we know that we have to get our acts together to get this planet back on track, and this plastic problem, and this racial problem, and this poverty problem. You know, it really is going to take, it's going to take our global village to get this together. So we need all hands on deck, including the people in prison. And that's the piece that I'm working on.
So just about 30 seconds left. Are you planning expansions? Are you coming to Oregon, for example?
I'm really excited about what Colette Peters is doing at the DOC in Oregon. And I want to bring our trauma-informed trauma talks curriculum to her and all the people in Oregon. Absolutely. And Oregon, you know, Oregon's one of the great states, in my opinion. There's really what you're doing with your drug policies and your human rights policies is a leadership model. Let's bring adverse childhood experiences and trauma-informed care to all your prisons this year. Let's do it. We can, it's urgent. Let's do it.
Compassion Prison Project, Fritzi Horstman, the founder. Thanks so much for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you, Jeff.